Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers. Now, my guest today is the renowned economist, Lord Jim O'Neill. Known for calling it right, his are views that are sought around the world by leaders in government, captains of industry alike. As chief economist of Goldman Sachs, he coined the BRICS to describe the emerging economies of Brazil, Russia, India, and China as the superstars of the future. And as commercial secretary to the Treasury, he found his true north as champion for the Northern Powerhouse. And his power to predict saw him raising the public health spectre of superbugs long before today's pandemic. Receiving his peerage in 2015 as Baron O'Neill of Gatley, he did so with his motto, always try your best. Well, let's give it your best today, Jim. Welcome to Changemakers. I'd like to start there, actually, with the motto, always try your best. The world in 2020 trying its best against a very big enemy in the pandemic. Looking at this world from the lens of an economist, is it trying its best? How do you see it?
So in the context of how you described my CV and my experiences, a very important influence on my mind throughout the pandemic is the fact that I dreamt up the BRIC acronym on the back of 9/11 in 2001. Within days of that horrific event, my mind, to my surprise, started deviating into thinking that there was some sort of underlying deeper message to the world that without, you know, the world had, or some part of the world had had enough of Americanization, let's call it. And that was the sort of more subtle thing behind the horror. And that's what started me off on the whole thing about the BRICS. And of course, as in every intro I get to anything, the BRIC thing is always mentioned. It's stamped on my forehead for the rest of my life. So I know that how I reacted in that crisis changed my professional life. And so it's made me realize that how all of us as individuals or everybody as leaders of businesses or companies or governments or perhaps even countries, how we respond in a crisis, including the circumstances in which the crisis has happened, can be the making of that person, that leader, that country, and so on. So, and with it, you know, the infamous motto, never let a crisis go to waste. I'm a huge, huge fan of that.
I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, the acronyms that we're going to be creating in the kind of the next chapter in the post-coronavirus future. I mean, is it still the BRICS? I mean, do you see the future being dominated by very different countries than perhaps we're seeing at the moment?
Well, I'm going to just finish for now with the previous theme where I've answered, and then I'll come on to this. You know, what I feel coming out of this crisis about business in general is something you and I have touched on in the past, but I feel it even more now, is what I'd call profit with purpose. But let's come back to that. On the BRICS, I joked last week it was the 12th anniversary of the BRICS political leaders meeting. These guys helped make it famous by actually having a political leaders club named after it. And I tease them that they often forget that they never asked me whether they could do that. But anyhow, I joked on a call linked to that last week that maybe I should have called it ICS. Because in the second decade of it, neither Brazil have been particularly successful, to put it mildly. And when I reflect back 19 years ago, because we're very close to the day of 19 years ago when I first published about the topic, and China has actually continued to outperform what we assumed would be happening by now, and India's pretty close to what we did. But of course, the second decade for Brazil and Russia has been very disappointing. So maybe it should have been ICS. Or put it like this, if Brazil and Russia don't have a better first half of this decade, then perhaps people will eventually forget about the acronym.
Right. Well, we've gone BRICS to ICS. Let's go back to profit with purpose, because, I mean, you mentioned that. I mean, I suppose right now, the ultimate realization of that is in the vaccine, AstraZeneca, and its decision to not make any profit from its work on a vaccine. Do you think that, I mean, obviously its share price hasn't necessarily reflected that noblesse oblige, if you like. I mean, is capital following the idea, do you think, that purposeful business is a really important part of our future?
So I think the whole pharmaceutical response and the way AZ and Pfizer have been, and others, including their own cooperation with each other and with biotechs and the way the markets have priced them, is amongst the enormous number of fascinating aspects just within the world of finance about this crisis. And I don't know is the answer, but I'll give you some somewhat contradictory answers. But it leaves me hopeful.
You're an economist, Jim. You're entitled to give me contradictory. It goes with the territory.
You want a few of the on the one hand and on the other.
On the one hand, yeah, and on the other. Come on, give us that.
But the most important thing, which frankly more broadly leaves me in many ways so optimistic about the big picture of the future. Given my experience on antimicrobial resistance and my knowledge of what motivates a lot of big pharmaceutical companies, somebody would have said to you or I this time, the end of November 2019, that within another 12 months, three pharmaceutical companies would have developed a new vaccine. People would have said you were completely nuts. And the speed at which these guys have done what they've done is not only in itself, obviously, thank God, fortunate, given that it now gives us some kind of end date. But the more I reflect on it, the more I think that this could be a game changer about the whole way these firms think about the speed of their response to these kind of external pandemic shocks, as well as, I hope, antibiotic resistance. Now, the general view a year ago, and still is amongst a lot of vaccine skeptics, that you're very lucky to find a vaccine that ever really works, and if you do, it'll be over a decade, and people cite HIV and what have you and others. And so it is truly spectacular, but even more broadly, it makes me think that if you get the right attention on the topic and given the power of technology and science and determination, we can crack all sorts of problems. And of course, the huge applicability for climate change.
Interestingly, when I co-wrote Mission, I remember interviewing an entrepreneur that said, make no mistake, we're living in a world of dog years, that actually, every new year is like seven old ones. And it strikes me that a lot of the debate we've heard this year about, mumps and AIDS and how long it took to create sort of mitigation strategies and vaccines felt almost like, there was one world which was the scientists and the technologists that were looking at how fast they could do things, and then a political and economic world that hadn't really caught up to the fact that change might happen very quickly. I mean, is that how you see it?
Yeah, completely. I sort of, in a sort of very narrow, subjective way, I joked to myself many weeks that maybe I should have been a prop trader through this crisis, because as soon as April, and I'm very, very, I couldn't have done some of this because it might have got close. It wouldn't have been insider trading, but I certainly felt reasonably well informed. As soon as April, I became pretty persuaded that before the year was over, we'd have at least two vaccines. And I would speak to a lot of people that have been in the health world, health economics world, and the broad health policy world. And they were like, you don't have a clue what you're talking about. And I'd tell you, 95% of the people I'd engage with would say that. And here we are. And going, not forgetting the original question about how the markets price these things. On the one hand, for AZ to become so a valuable member, part of the UK stock market, linked to this is kind of silly, because obviously they're not going to make anything like the revenue stream that they typically do with a new drug fine. But maybe it's a deeper message about assigning value.
I was thinking exactly, you're saying, is it about a new definition of value?
So I think it could be partly that. I mean, in parallel with this, one of the most fascinating things to me about individual sectors and stock markets is, let's go to the energy business and how you have some solar storage or solar power generated businesses in the States that are now worth more than Exxon. Look in the auto sector, of course, with Tesla, worth more than, by considerable distance, any conventional auto firm.
What you're talking about is reminding me, I interviewed as part of Changemakers, David Petraeus, who was the US general in Iraq, who came up with Surge as his theory of military sort of, you know, advance. And it's got me thinking, though, you mentioned climate change, is that will Surge become the commercial strategy of actually getting hold of the world's big problems and putting capital, ideas and talent together to actually solve the big questions of our time? Is that where capitalism might go?
I mean, it gives me huge hope. I'm sure that there are obviously various things that could come to oppose it. And, you know, there's all sorts of dilemmas out there. But so I'm being presumptuous, but I'm sort of assuming we're over the absolute peak problematical part of this crisis. And that's at the core of that is this thing about the vaccines, and we'll have them to distribute soon, and it'll get bigger and bigger. But it sort of gives me great inspiration about this Surge idea you describe, because it shows that you can have a hugely more successful response to some existential threats in a way that, you know, most people just mentally, even now, aren't prepared to sort of consider. And there's endless examples that I come across. And it's quite exciting with it, particularly generationally. A lot of young people throw ideas at me because I get involved in VC investment quite a bit, as you probably recall. Number of ideas I get from young people about quite dynamic things to do with climate change is fantastic. And, you know, I think the markets are showing a rather persuasive sign. If you come up with some initiative that can be commercially successful to help beat climate change, the markets will reward you very quickly.
Mm. I mean, so when you hear, I mean, closer to home, and we'll move off the pandemic in a minute, but when you hear things like our Chancellor's statement about, you know, a pretty sort of gloomy future at the moment in terms of the economic prospects, I mean, does this put you back into the V camp in terms of the way that, you know, the economy might bounce back? Or actually, does this mean that countries like the UK just move into the slow lane from here on in?
Listen, I think the UK, well, three things. First of all, I am in the V camp, but that's despite UK policymaking, and we can get into that. Secondly, the UK has had a very bad crisis in terms of the country's ability to do stuff, with the huge exception that one of these three early vaccine finders is British. But in terms of how effective our civil service has been, and of course our government, you know, this should cause for serious reflection on the institutional nature of how we operate. Because whichever way you look at it, in a relative league table, the UK has underperformed what it should have been capable of doing. But notwithstanding, my first point is, I am in the V camp. And the third thing I would say is, let's, going back to my opening comment, let's see whether any of the current policymakers or their advisors themselves can learn from a crisis. Because, you know, there's going to be other challenges down the road, and how people respond is crucial.
I should remind you, as an economist, Jim, that hope is not a strategy. Do you get a sense? I mean, well, actually, let's move on, because I think, I suppose the question is that, you know, you sort of listening to you, is I suppose there is a difference between optimism and positivity in the things that you're talking about. I mean, I think as a genuinely positive person, you know, that there's a positive outlook that we could bounce back. Let's talk about where that comes from. Now, we've both got a bit of Northern soul, different sides of the Pennines, and of course, you know, I'm sort of thinking about you. I mean, we know the story now, as you mentioned BRICS. You've worked in government, there are lots, but let's go back. I mean, you know, as I understand it, it was an A-level textbook about North America that first got you interested in economics. Tell us what we've got to. Got to thank for the original inspiration.
Let me throw in another. Funnily enough, somebody in China was quizzing me about it the other day, and they found it very amusing, my answer, but it's true. So when it came, I was doing my O levels, I was a pretty pretty disinterested pupil. I was a very naughty teenager that basically played football. But because of my dad and the expectations surrounding my sisters, who were all older than me and myself, you know, there was a presumption we would do A-levels and then go on to something. And I had no idea what I'd wanted to do at A-levels. And here's the story that's key to your question. I went to explore doing biology, and the biology room happened to be next door to the economics room. And the queue to get into the biology room to quiz the teacher was so big, I thought, I can't be bothered with this. And the queue to go in the economics room was empty, so I went in there.
So it's like sliding doors for economists. I mean, you could literally...
Exactly.
Well, I suppose maybe that explains some of the interest in
there you go.
In vaccines.
There you go. Never thought of that one. So that's it. So it started from that. And then what happened was, I was already quite interested in geography, so I knew I was going to do that. And in geography, we had to choose specialist topics, and I decided that I'd focus on North America. And to my surprise, I found myself in towards the end of that first of the 2 years of my A-levels, many, many midweek evenings when I get home, being absolutely fascinated by opening a book into different pages of America's geography and really, really seriously taking it all in.
So it's physical geography or it's economic geography?
So it was economic geography that really got it. It was the physics that attracted me, the physical geography that attracted me to it. But I found myself being really stimulated by the economics of the geography. So the whole issue of how the steel industry built up in Pennsylvania. I remember it now. I was lying on the floor in my parents' freezing cold back room, sitting by the electric fire that we all had in those days. But I would spend a good 2 hours sort of being, you know, absolutely fascinated about all these weird places in Pennsylvania and Ohio that were producing steel. Mm.
So quite imaginative, about thinking about that world outside of growing up.
I guess. Very different for me. And people, my sisters, I'll never think, well, we're quite pally still, but my eldest sister at the time, who's, what, 5-6 years older than me, she was already way off at university, and she used to think I was such a moron, she used to refuse to speak to me. And it wasn't, this is true, it wasn't until I'd gone through my degree and it became clear I was going to go on to do post-grad, particularly my PhD, she suddenly started speaking to me and treating me with respect, which was most amusing.
I mean, it's interesting when you look at the stories of the people I interview, is that quite often, and I was saying to you off air, is that quite often their lockdown lists really reveal things about their character. And I think yours is no exception, because, I mean, you know, you don't need me to tell you the esteem that you're held with in the business and political world as an economist. But all of your heroes are very physical heroes. They're footballers. They're George Best. They're Dennis Law. They're Alex Ferguson. I mean, you know, people might have expected you to have like sort of reeled off a few world famous economists. But in terms of that sporting interest, I always remember my favorite Alex Ferguson line was, I went to listen to him when he wrote his book, and he used this line, he said, "I've never played for a draw in my life." And I thought, if that doesn't tell you something about attitude and character, I don't know what does. What is it that's in sporting characters that an economist sees that perhaps he doesn't see in the political, economic, or business world?
Wow, what a fascinating question. You know, I love the thing about sport, particularly football, and I played a lot of football. I was completely obsessed with football. In fact, you know, I was one of these. I actually played at Old Trafford for Manchester Schoolboys, and I, you know, like anybody at those 8 years, I had this ridiculous dream that was what I was going to be. And when I didn't make the final hit, I think 8 of the team I played in got signed up by clubs, and I was kind of like felt like an idiot and mortified. But frankly, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me that I didn't, because only one of them ever sort of really made it big as such, and that wasn't for very long. But anyhow, you know what. I'll give you two parts of answering this really interesting question. I think on a football field, you can see in your own team who's really trying to put in proper effort. And there's something about the spirit and camaraderie of a team-based sports game that you just I just haven't found that you can replace in many other walks of life. And it's, in that sense, it's very honest.
Honest. I mean, I suppose, and it's the feel of it. We were also talking about how, you know, you had the Manchester Pink in Manchester, yes, which was the, you know, the free sheet that came out after the game. We had the Green and in Sheffield.
I remember that too, because I was at university there.
You were at the university there. But they were miracles of the game in some respects, because that, you know, you'd be there minutes afterwards getting those sort of newspapers, pretty weighty newspapers as well in terms of the amount of information. And I suppose they brought the drama to life.
I mean, I think that it takes me to the second thing, really, that obviously it partly reflects the nature of your upbringing. I had a slightly peculiar family background. That my mother came from a Cheshire farming family, and my dad came from a, let's call it, an inner Manchester, not so well established family, and they're an odd pair. But they never had any money, and we went to, you know, normal schools in pretty tough places. And so you obviously you want to fit in and you mix by all of those. So in my teenage years, everybody wanted in Manchester, because I was raised in the era of Lord Best and Charlton, everybody wanted to be George Best, you know, including me. And you know, I had mates of mine who had sisters that George Best had, let's just say, enjoyed the company of, and you know, he had all these trendy clothes stores and God knows what, and you know, those things had a huge influence on you growing up. And the idea that there's some kind of great philosopher or an economist that would influence my development, I'm like, get out of here.
Okay, so that was the role of sport. It was the honesty. It was the romance. It was I guess
the ship, the passion and excitement. I mean, incredible.
Did you find, I mean, obviously, you know, it feels to me that you are a very passionate economist. I mean, I've heard you speak. I mean, you've got this creative ability to bring complex ideas to life. I mean, I suppose the question is, was there a light bulb moment where you thought, I can throw some of this kind of passion and identity into something like this, which on the face of it is a very dry, you know, sort of very bookish career and interest to take?
So I'll now take my answer to this down a sort of a path I probably not taught that openly to many people. I think most classically trained economists would probably regard me as a bit of a fraud, because I don't think economists are that smart, the ones that I've generally come at. They all think they're smart, and they don't accept for a start that it's a social science. And, you know, economics doesn't know the answer to hardly any of the things that it often claims it does. It has this brilliant ability to explain things that are going on. And I do think there's something rather powerfully basic about the price mechanism allocating scarce resources. But this notion that economists can confidently and repeatedly predict what's going to happen in the future is just sort of ridiculous. But despite what's happened the past 20 years or so, so many of them do. And it's kind of mad. And so I remember in the early days of my professional life, a couple of foreign exchange traders would call me a dirty economist. And actually, I rather quite like that. And I guess what I'm really getting at, and it did influence me, because what I somehow, and it might be a reflection of my love of sport, but also partly my background of living with this different father background, different mother background, no money, but somehow getting into the university system. But it made me realize that big things can be done if you just really focus on the key simple parts of what makes them such challenges. And a lot of big problems get overcomplicated by so many people. And I used to find it a lot at Goldman, with a lot of people there were so classically really bright, but in terms of the issue they were trying to deal with every day or every week, they weren't very savvy or very sensible.
I mean, I'm wondering, did that kind of, that being grounded, applied common sense, I mean, did that, is that, I'm thinking, is that part of the formula?
I'd never thought of it that way, but that's quite probably it.
Because I'll tell you why. I would describe you, Jim, as a leader, and you commented on leaders on lockdown. You know, you mentioned Obama, and you know, you've met many presidents, prime ministers. But what I loved was that your usual reaction is, rather than the kind of the awe of the grandeur of state or whatever it might be, is what on earth motivated them to become a national leader? I mean, give us a bit more in terms of why you felt like that.
Well, because from my experience, and I think I've met three ex-US presidents, and I think I've met every prime minister going back to Maggie Thatcher's days, and of course, having spent 17 months as a minister in a government, you just see how utterly obsessive the narrow world in which everything they have to decide and do is. And I'm just kind of, you know, the obsession with power and influence must be something there. But I, and of course, somebody's got to do it. And we've had great leaders, and we will get great leaders. But I'm just not quite sure of the sort of personality traits that lead to people wanting to do those things. And I'm like, ugh.
Did your own time in government leave you more positively or negatively sort of about the experience and about, I guess, the idea of the politician in society?
So I've absolutely no regrets about my extensive 17-month experience, but deciding to leave was one of the easiest calls I ever made in my life.
Why was that?
Well, because first of all, the whole role of being a minister in the House of Lords essentially requires you, because of the peculiarities of many peculiarities about the House of Lords, you're just basically on call to vote at anywhere from 3 o'clock till midnight, any Tuesday through Friday. Sorry, any Monday through Thursday. And it meant I had to be completely abandon my personal life. So in that sense, it was more annoying than aspects of government. Not least because it was often a load of stuff I didn't care less about.
But I suppose that's the experience, the character though, I suppose.
So the more substantive thing is what I couldn't believe is the repeated signs of many politicians that they were just in it for the game, and they didn't really have a philosophy, and they didn't really want to stick to the principles of some philosophy. They just wanted to know where they were in the pecking order of their party and where they were going next. And it seems to me very shallow.
I mean, I'm so sorry. We're on to my last part of my question. I could go on for a lot longer, but I was also looking at the lockdown list. I was thinking, where do I get that last question? Because I know you're watching The Sopranos, but I did love the fact that on your lockdown song choice list was the Foo Fighters cover version of Times Like These.
I love it.
And in Times Like These, you learn to live again. Yeah. I mean, finish that thought for us in terms of Jim in coronavirus. What have you learned about yourself? What do you think about that next chapter, that next phase?
I mean, I love, there's something about the way that track was put together and all the people in it. And I have to say, contrast that with the other one that's just come out recently of Children in Need. I could be declaring a bias here because, of course, the Gallagher brothers are Manchester City fans, so I'd never really...
The noisy ones.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's something beautiful about it. But underlying it, the theme about how we learn to live again is kind of, in some ways, a close cousin of Always Try Your Best.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, is it Try Your Best? Yeah.
You know, it kind of, you know, I've been through many, many crises, economic crises in my professional life. And what I've obviously lived to tell so far the tale is that you get out of the other side. And so, you know, I see so many people that sort of unfortunately struggle with this view that we're now in crisis forever. And I know that that's not true. And as I go back to what I said earlier, that how you think about some key matters and how you yourself choose to behave differently as a result of some developments is going to really have a material influence about yourself and those close to you and others going forward. And that's what I've learned again.
Jim O'Neill, thank you very much for joining me on Changemakers. And there you have it. Learn to live again. Try your best. It's all anyone can ever really ask of you. And doing your best in tough times is where you learn a lot about yourself and the world in which we all live. And thanks to my guest today, Lord Jim O'Neill. He's definitely done his best with a powerhouse performance and an energetic glimpse into the what might come next and part of his story. And for more stories about the shape of things to come, do join me again on The Changemakers.